I'm very happy now to welcome to the program Bill Saturno. He's an archaeologist, professor at Boston University, and he's the director there of the Guatemala Archaeology Program. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you for having me.
So you seem to have a very special gift for discovering ancient Mayan murals. You, in 2001, discovered the oldest intact Maya mural ever found, or murals, and about a decade later, you discovered another extraordinary mural in the same kind of general area. Tell us about the process of actually finding these sites.
Well, I mean, the first one happened to be sort of dumb luck on my part. I was out with a crew looking for carved hieroglyphic monuments and happened into a looter's excavation where Maya murals happened to be waiting for me. It was kind of them to wait for me there. For 2,000 years, they sat. The second time, actually, an undergraduate student that was participating in the Guatemala Archaeology Program came to Guatemala and said, well, if you found murals, I'll find murals. And on his lunch break one day while doing survey work at the nearby site of Shultun, he went into a looter's excavation and found the remnants of paint on a wall. It wasn't very exciting what he saw, but our excavations later revealed a very exciting room.
You talk about looter's excavations. What do you mean?
Well, essentially, in the Maya lowlands of Guatemala and Mexico, there has been a fairly long history, and it's not an ancient history, but a long history of illicit excavations to fuel the illegal art market. So looters head out into Maya sites and excavate without permission, essentially looking for pots or jade that they might find in burials. And in doing so, they essentially cut through lots of architecture, discarding bones, doing all sorts of damage to the context of where those materials came from in order to, you know, find a pot that they might be able to sell. So those looters, their excavations into structures do a lot of damage to them, and they remove some of the data that archaeologists might hope to discover. At the same time, as archaeologists, we can go into those excavations, these cuts into the sides of buildings, these enormous gashes that we would never excavate ourselves. Right, the simple method of excavation wouldn't be one that we would choose because it's so damaging and so unstable. But going into those places, we can often make discoveries in their aftermath that they wouldn't have made themselves.
So the murals that you found are from two different periods in the Maya civilization. What periods was each one of them from, and what was happening at the time there?
Well, the San Bartolo murals are from around the first century B.C. That's a period of time that we would call the Maya preclassic, sort of the origins of the great Maya kingdoms that would later become classic Maya civilization. When people think about cities like Tikal or Copan, those are classic cities. The site of San Bartolo had these paintings painted from centuries before the classic period, depicting really stories of creation, and relating those stories of creation to the crowning of kings. Now, the murals at Shultun date to the early part of the 9th century AD, so about 900 years later. And they, too, contain the portrait of a Maya king, but the context of that portrait is dramatically different, in which the narrative isn't so much focused on justifying kingship through mythological means, but rather, the walls are covered with minuscule script, essentially trying to calculate these great periods of time that the Maya tried to tie their historical events into. So we've gone from a myth of kings, really, to a math of kings.
And so talk more about the math part. I mean, what was their math and scientific knowledge like as revealed on these walls?
Well, these walls at Shultun essentially demonstrate a series of calculations being made by Maya astronomers or calendar specialists that are calculating and predicting the motions of the Moon, Mars, Venus, etc., and tying those sort of motions into other important periods that they kept track of, whether that was the 365-day period of the sun or a 260-day ritual calendar that they focused on. So that there's essentially, they're looking at the math of their calendar systems and then looking at these astronomical cycles and trying to tie all of those things together, oftentimes recording, you know, sequences of days, millions and millions of days, you know, into the future, essentially looking for regularities in the motions and cycles that they're keeping track of.
The motions and cycles that they were keeping track of, how does their accuracy compare to our astronomical perspective?
Well, you know, there are certain things. Their solar year was a period of 365 days. And, of course, we know that the actual solar year is slightly longer than that. We estimate it as 365 and a quarter days, right? So that we have a leap year. Every 4 years, we add a day in order to keep our calendar in line with the actual duration of the solar year. Of course, even that doesn't quite do it, right? So that every 100 years, we don't add that leap day. And every 400 years, we actually do add that leap day. So it's sort of this dance that we're doing to
right.
try and keep our calendar in sync with the movement of the sun. Now, for the Maya, they were fine with being off that quarter of a day, understanding that the events in the solar year, its solstice, its equinox, its subsequent solstice, that those would simply migrate through their calendar, that every 4 years they'd be a day earlier, that every, 40 years they'd be 10 days earlier, so on and so forth. Now, that might indicate sort of less accuracy on their part, but it really demonstrates just a different way of looking at the sun compared to their calendar. We know that because when we talk about how they observe the moon and their lunar calendar, a lunar table that we have on the wall at Shultun does much the same thing that our leap years do. So that they've grouped lunations into groups of six because the actual period of lunation is 29 and a half days. And 29 and a half is not an easy thing to deal with mathematically. But if you group them into sixes, then you have 177 days equal to six lunations. And that's the number they like to use. But it's not accurate because it's not really 29 and a half. And on this table, what they're doing is every five or six groups of six, they add an extra day. So that in the end, after 162 lunations, they've calculated out 162 lunations is 4,784 days, which is incredibly accurate. It means that it's about a few minutes off a year. So they're capable of those type
good.
Of things. Yeah, they're pretty good.
Yeah. So we're talking to archaeologist Bill Saturno. There was so much kerfuffle about the Mayan calendar last year, and I have to say I'm glad it's over. But one of the things that people were talking about with your work was that what they found on the walls at Shultun really projected way beyond 2012, and I think thousands of years into the future. Is that right?
Well, I mean, certainly I would also second that. I'm really glad that the kerfuffle has ended to a certain degree. Not only at Shultun, but there were numerous other Maya inscriptions that, in fact, talk about time, not just thousands of years of time, but millions of years, actually octillions of years, units of time that are so enormous that, of course, we can't really even fathom them, right? So, I mean, the Maya calendar itself, never anyone that knew it in reality showed no sign of ever ending. It's simply a way of projecting cycles large and small, both into the past and into the future. And they looked deep into the past and likewise, they expected those cycles to repeat long, long, long into the future.
What do these walls, these murals, both in San Bartolo and in Chultun, tell us about the social structure of the Maya who were living in those times?
Well, it certainly allows for a point of comparison, and certainly comparing a society, you know, even the same society after 900 years, one anticipates profound change as well as some traditions being the same. In this instance, it shows really what the preoccupations of kings were and how different those preoccupations were in the first century BC versus the 9th century AD, where in the former, they're really sort of justifying, you know, the origins of the institution of kingship, right? That's what they're demonstrating, their descent from ancestral deities, their role as intermediary between the gods and man. In the classic period, at the end of the classic period, really, in the 9th century, they're still very much serving that role as intermediary. Their right to rule is descended not only from this sort of divine inheritance of the gods, but more practically, through a hereditary kingship, right? I'm king because my dad was king, or my uncle was king, and I've been named king appropriately. But that isn't just simple enough, right? You can't just say, I'm king for this reason. You need to be able to demonstrate those connections. And the way that you demonstrate them in the 9th century is by being able to calculate when all of the anniversaries are of the important events in your past, right? The important events in the city's past, in its mythic past, in its historical past, and project those things towards the future. And the way you do that is with math more than with myth.
I can't help but think that, I mean, when you look at any other culture besides our own, everybody's trying to predict the future. We're doing the same thing. We build scientific models about climate change. We build economic models and always fail to figure out what the stock market is going to do and things like that. But we're trying. So give us more of a sense of what kind of things they were trying to predict. I think those are... I mean, what we try to predict is such an indication of what we think is important.
Well, what's interesting is that they weren't ever really trying to predict anything. They were, in the sense that they weren't trying to interpret what the future might hold. What they were trying to demonstrate was that the things that happen now will repeat in the future. The things that happened in the past, even a very distant past, will repeat as these astronomical cycles repeat, right? So that the world is knowable and predictable in that sense, right? But there isn't a specifics to it. It's not like on the day such and such, this will happen, right? There's no prophecy about it. It's really about creating a model for understanding change and seeing it as a reflection of events of the past as much as it is about the present or the future.
I think in popular culture, there's kind of a, people tend to contrast linear and cyclical time. And it seems to me that the way you're talking, it sounds like both things are kind of happening simultaneously. There's movement from point A to B, but then there's also a sense of larger cycles.
Yeah, I mean, certainly for the Maya, that contrast between linear and cyclical wouldn't necessarily be one that was fully appreciated, mainly because our perception even of a linear time would for them likely be seen as just a very long cycle. Right? I can consider, you know, if I'm talking about a cycle of 144,000 days or, you know, 1,800,000 days, well, that's a cycle that no one sees repeat, right? That's a cycle that creates a sense of linearity, or, you know, in your own life. But if considered part of a much larger picture, you understand it as just part of a long cycle. I mean, part of it comes from us that, you know, in our society, in Western society, in a Judeo-Christian society, time just wasn't that long ago, right? I mean, in terms of the origins of things as discussed, as much as they are discussed, in the Bible, where, you know, the world was just a few days older than us. Right, you sort of have, you know, 4004 BC was actually the calculation done in the, you know, in the 16th and 17th centuries in terms of when creation took place. Well, 4004 BC, that's not very long ago compared to a Maya conception of time where creations happen, you know, millions or octillions of years ago. Right, that's just a different sense of how long time is and how small our part in that time frame is. So understanding that it's cyclical is really important to seeing you having any role. Right? If it's linear, we don't make a mark.
That's right.
The only way we make a mark is if it repeats.
So do we have a sense of what their creation story was?
Certainly, we get a lot of imagery associated with the stories of creation, and there certainly are many stories of creation. Interestingly, in those stories of creation, the Maya never talk about the end of days, right? There isn't a, you know, there was all this sense of, oh, there's an apocalypse coming. There's the end of the calendar equals the end of creation equals the end of time. The Maya had story multiple creations in which, you know, animals were created and people were created multiple times, essentially improving on each iteration until we were created. Right? But there wasn't a sense that that creation was somehow incomplete or flawed and that would later be judged and seen unfit and replaced by a subsequent creation. They didn't have that conception, right? There were previous creations that were unfit, and those were done away with and eventually replaced with us. But now that we're here, they got it right that time. The gods nailed it with our creation. So there wasn't a sense of impending doom that they would be found wanting and be replaced by some other creation. All of that comes from a sort of Western perspective of, you know, that there's a fall from grace, that we're imperfect and, you know, later we'll be judged. The Maya didn't have that sense. That was just, we're here, they got it right with us.
It's interesting when you talk about the multiple creations, animals being created over and over. Do you ever look at that in terms of how compatible that is with our narrative of evolution?
Well, I mean, it's essentially people trying to they're looking at this same world, and they're trying to understand their place in it, right? So that seeing things like the animals that just seem much older than we are, right? They have abilities that we don't have, right? They can fly, they can swim underwater, they can run much faster, they can do all of those things. And so the Maya certainly weren't the only culture to imagine that the gods gave gifts to the animals that that predated their own creation, right? But the one thing that animals don't do is they don't worship. Right, and of course, what do gods want? Gods want to be named. They want people to understand them, to respect them, to be able to pronounce their names. And so these earlier creations for the Maya, whether the people were made of mud or made of sticks, you know, those people weren't able to do that. They were either ignorant or cruel, right, representing characteristics that we wouldn't like to see in ourselves, that we imagine only existed in the past, but that eventually gods made us from ground corn, right, the center of civilization. Like, what makes us us is our ability to produce food, and that food for the Maya was corn, and they mix it with their own blood. The gods sacrifice themselves to bring life to us. right? So that justifies the whole need for auto sacrifice, to sacrifice captives, to add blood back into this system that's been brought about by sacrifice. And so that's how they come up with that. But they're not alone in that idea, that notion of multiple creation. The Greeks weren't that far off, right? They talk about, Prometheus, right? And Epimetheus, his brother, who's my favorite of the Greek gods. I love there's the Greek god of forethought and afterthought. That's really very funny, right? And so the idea that he gave away all the gifts and so that there was nothing left. Just like a guy of afterthought, right? Epimetheus gives everything away and says, oh, right, humans, I knew I should have saved something. Forgot about right. that. Sorry. Right? So, there's that same sort of sense that there's what separates us. And in that story, of course, Prometheus gives fire. Right? And that is what separates humans from the animals around them. And it's something, of course, the gods were unhappy with in that instance. But, this is how creation stories evolve, right? Creation stories are based on observing the world around you and trying to make you fit into them, right? And
exactly.
So evolution does that as well, just with a lot more scientific data.
Now, when you excavate a site like Shultun, and you've got these incredible murals that just emerge. I mean, it's almost magical to see. I was watching one of the little videos online of you chipping away and this gigantic, beautiful thing being revealed. It's a long process after that to understand it and preserve it and study it. I mean, this goes on for years, and there's a lot of people from different disciplines involved with this. Is that right?
Oh, most certainly. The excavation itself is really the tip of the iceberg. There's a lot of time before the excavation and getting things ready and prepared so that you know that when you excavate it, it's not going to be immediately destroyed by the environment around it. And you have specialists in wall painting conservation and artists and folks to document it both with photographs and in drawing and in every manner you can. But then there are epigraphers and iconographers and astronomers and mathematicians. I mean, this is certainly not the work of one or even just a few people. This involves a lot of minds to try and tease out the meaning of these things that were recorded often ephemerally and millennia ago.
And then how does that ongoing research and discovery and paper writing translate to the public? I mean, is it pretty much within academia, or do we get to really hear about it?
It's very funny because I don't know how that works necessarily. I sort of go about my business doing my job. But periodically, sometimes there are things that I find or others find that somehow grab the attention, for whatever reason, of a more popular audience. And then it's really our responsibility to try and make sure that the most accurate information that can get out gets out. And that's very rarely in our hands. I mean, I can't tell you the number of times in which, because the media is about superlatives in general. With San Bartolo alone, is this the oldest mural ever found? My answer to that question was no. It isn't the oldest one found. Of course, there are other ones earlier. There's ones that are contemporary with it. It's in really good shape, so it's the most complete one if you need a superlative, but from that period. But it's part of a body of things that we find. Is it the largest one ever found? Well, no, it's not the largest one ever found either. It's neither the oldest nor the largest. And I've had people say, can I say it's the biggest oldest?
Oh, my goodness.
Like, why would you think you could say that? I understand that I answered no to both questions, and you're thinking that that's a double negative, but they were different questions.
Right.
So, but it's that kind of thing, so that it comes out. I can't tell you how many reportings of the finds at Shultun were oldest Maya calendar found.
Right.
No. not the oldest Maya calendar, and not even really a Maya calendar. you know, it sort of creates the impression that there's this, you know, thing on the wall you can rip pages off of. That's not what we found. We found astronomical tables which had calendrical information in them, and it was certainly the earliest ones of those that we've ever found. But you know, oldest calendar. Okay, again, a double negative. Not a calendar, right. Not the oldest. Check, check.
Right, right.
So, you know, we're often not in control of how the media either portrays what we do or metabolizes what we do or essentially creates a fiction of what we've done.
Bill Saturno is an archaeologist, professor at Boston University, where he's the director of the Guatemala Archaeology Program. Thank you so much for being on the Radio Cafe.
Thanks for having me.